Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, April 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us once again to talk about recent events, developments, and technologies in the field of climate change and alternative energy research is Dan DeLury, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at the Vermont Law and Graduate School and former White House Director of Clean Energy. Dan has decades of experience, including as an exec with utilities and clean energy companies. You have a question? You want to weigh in on the conversation? Love to have you. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Dan DeLury and your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Here once again to take your climate change and alternative energy questions is none other than Dan DeLury, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Decades of experience, including as an exec with utilities and clean energy companies. Dan is the former White House Director of Clean Energy, where he focused on the decarbonization of the nation's electricity system. A UN-accredited delegation head to the UN climate change meetings known as COPs, Dan is a pioneer in developing content, policy, and programs that combine climate change with new electricity technologies. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dan DeLury, welcome back. How are you, buddy?
I'm good, Ray, and thanks for having me back again.
I saw your LinkedIn post today saying you're coming down, and I almost sent one and said, better charge up your electric car. I want you here on time. But you made it in plenty of time.
I did.
So what's
with
new?
Electricity to spare.
Good for you. Well, you got to make it back to Vermont.
That's right.
Good luck, brother. Hey, how are things going?
They're going well, yeah. I mean, it's springtime, even in Vermont.
Really?
At least, you know, once in a while.
Yeah, occasionally, right. Yeah. Well, it was pretty blustery yesterday, but it feels pretty good today. I had such fun today checking out, which I've done before, but I checked out your most recent Substack. And so I thought I printed the sort of highlights from it.
Sure.
And I'll give you some of the headlines and let you comment on some of this stuff.
Okay.
By the way, before we start, people can find you on Substack. How?
Just Dan DeLury Substack.
It's called Climate.
Well, Climate Time is the name of it, but if you just go to Substack or just in Google and do Dan DeLury,
yeah,
and DeLury is DeLury, Substack, you'll get it.
You gotta snap up that name a little. Maybe Climate Fun.
You mean DeLury or Climate Time?
No, wacky climate hijinks or something.
Okay.
All right, so I'm going through a couple of these, and you just riff on them a little bit.
Sure.
This is from your most recent Substack. Guess what kind of U.S. clean energy record was set in 2025? I'll bite. What?
Yeah, well, it was actually solar and wind as the size of the slice of the pie.
As a percentage?
As a percentage that they contributed to electricity. But that's kind of easy to understand. But the other thing I will add to that is even though we're adding more and more solar and wind, and also storage and other things, that that the pie is expanding. We're still adding, especially now with the new electricity demands from data centers and just the overall expansion of demand, we're also building new natural gas plants. And so, you know, where the amount of solar and wind is getting bigger, it doesn't necessarily mean that we've got a good handle on the emissions reduction issue.
Interesting. And then you pointed to another one, maybe down your list a little bit, and it kind of caught my eye. This sunny state ranks last in solar. Seems like this may be the reason, ? All right, what is it?
Oh, right, that's Alabama.
Alabama is last in solar.
Yeah, and Alabama has a pretty high backup fee.
What do you mean?
Well, meaning that solar is intermittent and variable. I mean, that can't be denied.
Right.
Okay. But when solar is tied into a utility system, the utility has all sorts of options by which they can shift for how they're getting their power. And in many cases, if not most, there's no charge for that. The customer imputed electricity is considered a bonus to the system.
Ah.
But if in places where solar, I mean, Florida for a long time was a place where there was hardly any solar energy. And that was because of policy that made it a little bit more difficult and in some cases more costly for solar energy.
You had said, we were just chatting before the show started, you said that California set a record recently for energy released, used from batteries.
Yeah, batteries is are you know, both the holy grail and the sleeping giant, so to speak. More and more batteries, and we're talking about utility scale batteries, not, you know, home batteries here, although that's increasing too. But the record was on one day, the hours in the middle of the day, which are crucial to the electricity system when demand is high,
yeah,
on one day last month, the entire electricity load was met by batteries.
And lead-acid batteries? What are we talking about here?
It's a mixture of batteries. I mean, some are conventional, but it's more likely to be a lithium-ion battery.
Yeah.
But there are all sorts of storage. I mean, battery is being used loosely here to describe all sorts of different ways for energy storage.
California is a pretty big state with a large electric load.
Right.
Where do you put all the batteries?
That's a good question. I mean, but these batteries, think of it like a... like a solar farm or a wind farm or something, although it doesn't have to be as expansive. But I mean, they're basically like putting in a generator, a small generator somewhere. I mean, some of them actually look kind of like a storage container. You know, I mean, so it's concentrated power.
Yeah.
It's not dispersed power.
Understood.
Like a solar farm would be.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Dan DeLore is here, and we'll get to your calls in a little bit. We're going through his most recent Substack article, which is really cool.
And it's also a test that I have to remember what I wrote.
Well, you're doing very well, at least by my account. I don't know.
All right.
States are taking the handcuffs off of nuclear.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been a continuing theme here that we've talked about on prior shows. Nuclear is zero emissions. I mean, you just have to consider that. You can, you know, argue around the edges with anything that has to be constructed and
so
on.
For instance, the waste and where to dispose of
Well,
it.
Well, the waste is not an emissions issue.
Right.
Although, interestingly, the state of Utah, I think this was in my Substack, you know, this I alternate between things that caught my eye, where
right.
I do a miscellaneous list, and then I do an essay on something or an op-ed.
Right.
But I think it was in the one before that Utah is actually angling to build a waste repository for not just itself, but for the country. And that's long been an issue. The waste has been successfully stored on site at nuclear plants around the nation. There was an attempt to build one in Nevada. But now Utah is apparently stepping forward to do that. But I feel like I've strayed on the original question that, and from a policy standpoint.
You're riffing, man. You're riffing. You do what you got to do.
But no, from a policy standpoint, some states have bans.
Yeah.
I think that's what the piece was in my Substack.
So according to the summary that is on this page, five states, Wisconsin,
right,
Kentucky, Montana, West Virginia, and Illinois have lifted moratoria on new nuclear plants.
Right.
Another five, California, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Vermont, have pending legislation that would do the same.
That would do the same. And also all six New England states, the governors all got together and issued a proclamation that they want to do nuclear in New England.
It's amazing how times have changed. Now, you have often mentioned how you are one of those long-haired hippies who was involved with the No Nukes and Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown and everybody else.
I protested at the gates of nuclear power facilities.
Yeah.
And then in the late 80s, when people started, scientists, in other words, like Jim Hansen, started to explain climate change, it was like, you know, a light bulb went off, and I said, well, okay. And then I even worked on the campaign for a presidential candidate in the 1991-92 election, and he was a noted environmentalist, and I convinced him that to be an environmentalist, you have to embrace nuclear. And he did.
Now, when you were in the Biden White House, you were obviously looking at new modes of alternative energy. But was there any, did you get any reading of the tea leaves of where the inclinations were in that administration toward nuclear?
Yeah, they were positive. It was, I have to say, it was not an issue that I worked on
right.
in the White House. But yet what I did work on was trying to help the agencies. The U.S. Government is the largest electricity purchaser in the country. And so they made a commitment under Biden, or Biden made a commitment to have the federal government buy additional low emissions or no emissions clean energy or whatever. But, of course, in order for there to buy it, there has to be it. You've got to have.
I like it.
Yeah, you've got to have it out there. And so my job was to try and work in some of these proceedings involving utility resource plans and what they're going to build in the future to try and make sure that they're indeed not just for the government, but for everybody, that there was more clean energy out there to buy.
Dan DeLore is our guest, and we have to take a break here in a minute. The number is 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And I've only hit a few topics from Dan's Climate Funhouse. What's it called?
Climate Time.
Climate Times on Substack. But you can read it yourself by going there. Final one, just 30
sure.
seconds. This is a great headline. Was the death of EVs in the U.S. greatly exaggerated? Question mark.
It was not. I mean, you know, and I have to admit, I wasn't expecting the war in Iran. And yet the price of oil, I mean, the showrooms for EVs, including at Tesla, Tesla surpassed its sales last month or the last 4 weeks or whatever, compared to the same period last year when the incentives were still available.
Amazing. All right. So you're optimistic about the future
and
of
used
EVs.
EVs are a bargain right now, although they're probably going to go up in price because of the interest in them.
But, you know, the stigma, of course, attached to anything that is used and electric is, oh, the battery's shot or the battery has 50% life. So how does one, as a used car buyer, make sure that this electric vehicle has a battery that has at least, you know, two-thirds life?
I can't speak to, well, first of all, you know what the mileage is on a battery, but they're now saying and seeing evidence that, I mean, these batteries may last for 150,000 miles.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break. Dan DeLore is our guest today. We'll get to the phones and the emails in a moment. 800-348-2551. VoxPop@WAMC.org. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, joined today by Dan DeLore, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Let's hit the email bag real quick, Dan, and then we'll go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Patrick writes, how would I best go about investigating and discovering what's necessary to add a solar recovery system for my home? Are there private sources that can help with this planning and layout? Planning it is interesting, right? You have to know how much you need and whether you have access to the right angle on the sun and everything else, right?
Oh, because I was just going to say I'm not sure what solar recovery
means. I think it's a clever way of saying solar power, I think. Unless,
like capturing solar
energy. Unless he's
going to
save the sun. Maybe the sun is
okay.
having an issue.
Yeah, I mean, well... You know, as with anything, I mean, whether it's a heat pump or whatever, there has to be a calculation as to what you need and whether it's attainable. You can actually go online. I think if you go to rewiringamerica.org, they have a tool, but there's other ones that you can Google for that allow you to use like Google Earth and to get an estimate as to how much electricity you can produce based on your home,
right?
Based on the roof. I mean, I had a friend go through this recently, and I mean, the roof angle, the pitch, all of those things matter. Some people who have a difficult home, shall we say, for solar on the roof, have gone to the panels in the back, which actually there are panels available. These stand on the ground, not a post, and they some of them are can track the sun, making them even more efficient.
Right.
But and Patrick, I'm not sure I'm answering your question all that well, but I mean it depends on many factors. You can't just say that, you know, I would love to have solar on my house in Vermont, but as I've said before, two things. I've got trees in front, which provide a lot of shade on my south-facing roof.
Right.
And my roof is slate, which I'd like to not necessarily disturb.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've electrified my whole house. I probably will put a panel in the backyard. I've got room for that.
Why don't you put a giant windmill up? Your neighbors won't mind, right?
Yeah. On that note, though, individual small-scale wind turbines have not really proven to be that cost-efficient.
Yeah.
That's why you don't see a lot of them. They've got to be of a certain size to make it. I mean,
yeah,
solar makes a lot more sense for a small-scale house or commercial operation.
Where did I see? Norway is... they're big in wind power.
Oh, absolutely.
But they're not that cool on solar power, apparently. Was that in your article, or did I read that somewhere
else?
No,
I don't think so. I wouldn't be surprised. Oh, no, I know what it was. Yeah, I think it was Denmark. Denmark is probably the greenest place on Earth, because unlike Norway, which produces a lot of wind and hydro, Norway also, you got to remember that they're one of the major oil producers on the planet.
Okay.
But in the case of Denmark, where wind has been totally accepted, particularly offshore wind, that now when people want to do solar on land, you're having the solar farm NIMBY problem crop up in Denmark.
Ah, yes. Our guest today is Dan DeLory. One more email, and then we'll hit the phones, and we'll go to the email bag later. So if you still want to write in, go for it. It's voxpop@wamc.org. John writes in. Subject heading, advanced geothermal technology. Dan, please give us your views on this tech. It seems to me it would be one of the very most promising to final paths to large projects leading to real advancement in reducing our use of carbon-based power.
Absolutely. Drill, baby, drill is what I say to John.
Quite a phrase.
Because geothermal, what's happened and what's made it night and day for geothermal is... Prior to fracking, geothermal meant going straight down until you found a heat source, and
right.
that could be cheap or prohibitively expensive.
Okay.
And what's given the geothermal industry new life is fracking technology, which involves horizontal drilling and all sorts of different ways to get to, instead of gas, in this case, getting to the heat source.
Now, wait a minute. I'm no expert on anything, really. But you go a certain amount of feet down, and it starts warming up, and it's pretty constant, right? I mean,
it is constant, but it's not.
Why do you have to go sideways is my point. I mean, you could go straight down, and it's the shortest path.
Yeah, assuming that heat, I mean, some of the heat is like 2,000 feet down. It's not all in the same place.
But isn't there a constant rate? Like if I go to Howe Caverns, it's a constant 53 degrees or whatever.
Right.
But then it starts getting warmer and warmer and warmer, does it not?
Well, it does, but it's just not even. Just as,
okay.
You know, and you're pressing me on what I know about
this. Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
But no, I do know that the reason that if you want to put a geothermal heat pump on your house, I mean, and I know specific instances of where the level that people had to drill down to varied as to where they could get enough heat to make it efficient and to make it make sense.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to the phones with Dan DeLory. And Dan, this is always a big moment for you. Let's go to Argyle and we'll go to Moyle. Merle, you're on. Go ahead.
Hey, Merle.
All right. This has to do with carbon tax.
Carbon tax.
Right.
The Amazon is getting, the people that live there are getting money not to cut trees. New York State, or at least in Washington County, New York State.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay.
Did we lose Merle? Oh,
Merle?
My God. Somebody, is Merle okay? Hello, Merle. All right.
Yeah, I could maybe comment, but do you want to wait and see if he calls back?
He's only halfway through, and probably with Merle, he's a quarter of the way through. Tell you what, we'll come back to Merle if he calls in again.
Okay.
800-348-2551, that's the number. And let's go to Kingston. And Britta, you're on.
Hi. I wanted to ask a little bit about what is meant by full load installation when it comes to heat pumps. Our family saved up a bunch of money and tried to get heat pumps in before the expiration of the federal tax credit, December 31st, and we got them put in and then found that they couldn't hold a set point and that they weren't enough to really supply the amount of heat that our fuel oil furnace had been supplying in the past. And thankfully, we didn't decommission our heat pump. So we did have, our fuel oil furnace. So we did have that as a backup during this winter. But now, you know, we're going back to the company that installed it and saying, hey, you guys said that this was going to be able to produce all of the heat that we needed. What does that full load mean that gives that makes these companies' installations be eligible for that federal tax credit?
Gotcha. Dan.
Oh, why? I kind of knew how I was going to start until you said that last thing in terms of being eligible for
the full load tax credit.
I mean, full load. I think you mean the full heating load. I mean, we talk about load as being the full electricity load, the full heating load, and whatever. And so, and I've been thinking since the last time I was on, all the way back in January, about heat pumps, because there were a couple of questions that came up, and it made me think about some of the basic things that, you know, you need to consider or think about with a heat pump. But in terms of the full load for the tax credit and what this company promised or did, I mean, I presume that they made some measurements in BTUs, right? They ran some calculations, right?
A model J is what it's called that's required for this. But you know, we have an old house. I'm hearing this from so many people here in Kingston that they installed them and then found out that they weren't actually able to totally heat their houses.
Okay. And so that's one issue, and that's separate from whether they qualify for the tax credit,
right?
I think. So in terms of whether it heats your house, and again, we've talked about this in the past.
You and I Ray's, argue about this all
the
time.
Ray's got heat pumps.
Britta,
I've got heat pumps.
Before Dan answers, Britta, just know that two or three years ago, we did this in my house.
Yeah.
And we have five wall units throughout the house and a couple different outside units. And the thing is, our house is terribly insulated, and this winter was so cold, those things were chugging, and we still had to run our on-demand natural gas boiler. You know, we still had to do it. We were going to freeze.
So a couple of things, and this is not to promote, but maybe to defend heat pumps or whatever. I grew up with steam radiators, and they were great. That's one kind of heat. There's electric resistance heat. Heat pumps are moving heat. They require, they're doing the heat exchange, obviously, but it's also moving air around, and moving air feels cooler. Now, I'm not saying that offsets the real cold that people were experiencing, okay? The other thing is, and this occurred to me on the last show, that you want to make sure that you're getting a heat pump that is rated as a cold weather heat pump. My heat pumps are rated to 20 below. Now, if you're in Arizona or you're some other place, you know, you don't need that. And that's not what you're going to buy. But and there may be old cold weather heat pumps are relatively new.
Well, ours are rated as good as you can get.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's still tough.
Yeah, ours too. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
The thing is, though, Dan, one thing that you brought up that is so true that doesn't apply to me because I have a big family and all the units are on all the time.
Yeah.
You can turn them off and just heat where you
are. It's a zonal system, and you know, I've used this phrase before in terms of one warm room,
right,
which I have to slow down to say.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have an electric space heater that I take to different rooms if I know I'm going to be in one of those rooms for a long time.
Yeah.
And so they are zonal. So that's an advantage.
Yes.
But, yeah, it was pretty cold. There are certain outdoor maintenance things, like you want to make sure that there's not snow on your heat pump.
For sure.
And a few other things. But, yeah, it's a different kind of heat and takes some getting used to in really cold weather. Now, here's one way to sort of look to the future and think,
yeah,
you know, and that is that we all felt pretty cold this past January.
Word.
Okay, but this past January was an average winter. We think it was colder, but if you look at the data, and this goes to the overall issue of global warming and temperature rise or whatever, it actually was an average winter.
Hold that
We've
thought.
Just forgotten what an average winter felt like.
Just stay up there on the soapbox.
Sure.
Britta, we'll say goodbye for now because I think Dan is about to pontificate about something else.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to talk you out of what you're experiencing, Britta. I mean,
ours. Don't get me wrong. I love
yeah,
ours.
Yeah, it is an issue. I think it's a question of, and again, remember on heat pumps or with anything else relative to energy efficiency, I never recommend that you just go out and do it. You do it upon replacement, or at least consider it
upon
replacement.
But she did it, though. She did it the right way, and she had the load tested and everything else.
Yeah.
Listen, I think it'll be worthwhile in the long run. That's my opinion.
Okay.
I mean, maybe her insulation's worse than mine, and it will never be.
Yeah, there are other factors to bring in, but that's not to deny what Britta is experiencing.
I can tell you one thing. The utility bills were pretty insane the last couple months.
Well, that's a prompt for me to say one other thing.
All
is
right,
that
watch.
Remember, when you're using electricity via a heat pump, you're not using something else.
That's cheaper
and so
than the electricity.
Well, I mean, oil is pretty expensive. And even when it comes back down, if it does, based on the world fluctuation right now. But you really don't have a lot of control over oil and gas prices. With electricity,
yeah,
they are regulated prices, and they are, you know.
Yeah, all right. Let's, you know what?
Okay,
Merle,
is that
Merle
enough on heat pumps?
That's good for now. Well, okay. You never know. Merle is back in Argyle,
okay,
and where we last left, well, I don't even remember. Merle, you're back on. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
All right. It has to do with carbon tax.
Okay.
And Amazon people there are getting paid for carbon tax, so not to cut the trees down. New York State is, they tax you more for trees, but they don't give you a carbon tax. Is there anywhere, or is there any progress, anything that's going on that would encourage people to grow trees and get a carbon tax in the United States, or in particular, New York State?
All right, brother, that's
good. That's a great question, yeah. Merle. So first of all, a carbon tax is something that is normally levied on everything. It's like, you know, a little adder that you put on the cost of this or the cost of that or whatever, and it's kind of universally applied. That's at least the idea of a carbon tax. What you're referring to is usually called a carbon offset. And so idea that instead of reducing emissions over here on the left, okay, you're preserving emissions over here on the right. And so I was involved.
Exactly.
I got in early from a policy standpoint on emissions back in the back in the 1990s. And it made perfect sense to me. It made perfect sense to everyone, but they proved to be much more difficult to implement and to preserve. There have been scandals and cheating and so on. A lot of that's been worked out. But also in the case of trees, the number of offsets, these are offsets that people had been paid for that went up in wildfires here and in Brazil, mainly out west, was pretty high. So, I mean, offsets are a challenging thing. And God knows we need offsets, but I'm not sure all that's been worked out yet. To finish, I think what you're talking about is the trees on your own land, I'm guessing. And so,
yeah. And to get a tax credit for keeping them there.
Yeah, for keeping them there. Yeah. I mean, there are.
And it's like the ag exempt. You have to have X amount of acres, 10 acres or something. 10 acres, I'll get ag. Why can't people with 10 acres of forest land get an ag exempt?
All right, yeah, what about that, Dan?
Well, I have an ag exempt for land that I have. And so, you know, that's for preservation of the land and keeping it from development and so on. When you get into carbon counting and carbon offsets, that's a more complicated process. You've got to really, I mean, you mentioned, I guess, Google has some that you know of or had heard of. And so, you know, they're doing that on a large scale,
right,
and they're subjecting it to very rigorous examination and calculation to do that. So, I mean, also, Ray, if you remember, in my last Substack, I talked about soil offsets.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's another one that farmers are really looking forward to. But again, it's a tough one when you get down to actually calculating it and figuring out, you know, how long that is going to be sequestered is the word. You want to sequester carbon.
Sequestration. Yeah. Let's take a break.
Yeah, Merle, thanks, Merle.
That was wonderful. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Yeah, buddy, 800-348-2551. That's the number. It's Vox Pop. We're joined by Dan DeLore today, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at Vermont Law and Graduate School. We do these things every few months, have a little chat with Dan. Having fun so far?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Loads of fun.
Good. All right, we took so many emails early. Let's go dispense with some of the callers that have been on the line a long time. We'll go to. Did you have something you want to bring up?
No, okay. I'm fine.
You're holding the microphone like Vic Damone. I thought you were going to sing a song. Let's go to John in Pine Bush. John, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I was a science advisor to an alternative energy company back in 2010. And at the time, we had I had researched the best solar in the United States, solar technology. And it was a company out of Caltech. And it produced 30% efficiency using 1/12 the footprint of the solar panels at the time. So it's 1/12 the size, but producing 30% efficiency. And it was incredible. We did a pilot study in Europe. It was completely successful. That company had $4 billion of pending orders, and they weren't able to borrow a dime from the banks. That year, a lot of companies went out of business. But at the time, this was in 2010. It was 30% efficient. It used had three junction technology. My understanding is now that they have five junction technology. And the idea of that is that it produces electricity even when it's cloudy. So if that was 15 years ago, there's no way that the technology hasn't improved in 15 years.
Okay.
Why are we seeing solar panels that are currently being sold that are the same basic panels that we had back in 2010 that are at 10%, 15% efficient?
Okay, so that's a good question.
Why can't we use
this? Yeah. Dan, what do you think?
Well, that's a tough one to answer, John. I mean, it sounds like you know more about the solar cell technology than I certainly do. I mean, it has been my understanding that the efficiency has improved incrementally along the way. And so I mean, why do you think that's the case?
Well, I know in that year, 160 United States manufacturers of solar went out of business.
Because
the banks were refusing to fund their projects.
Okay.
And at the time, they used the Solyndra debacle as an excuse not to fund solar.
Yeah. So just for everyone else, Solyndra was a major project funded by the Department of Energy.
This goes back to the Obama administration, right?
Yes. It wasn't solar. It was a major. In fact, I forget what the technology was, but it didn't work out. And politically, those who didn't want the new stuff that we talk about use that as a battering ram to talk about that. You know, the one other factor I want to mention, but I can't, you know, tell you an exact answer on your question, John, but the issue of China, I think, comes into play here, because China, now most solar cells, I mean, it's not, we're not a major manufacturing country when it comes to solar cells.
Well,
and that comes, I think, go ahead.
Quickly, though, we got to move on.
When the company that I was dealing with went out of business, they ended up going to auction, and the Chinese bought everything they had, all their technology, all their intellectual property, at 5 cents on the dollar.
And they were allowed to do
that. They brought it all to China. And
That's appalling.
And then the Chinese then refused to sell it to anybody. They only use it internally now.
Interesting.
Well, you know, this is
the
solar cell technology was invented in the U.S.
Right.
And as with other parts of the business world, we've not had a national policy, and particularly on what we're talking about, clean energy and so on. I mean, China has a national policy for clean energy, and they are going gangbusters. And we have at the moment a policy that goes against it.
John, thanks for the call. Great call. Appreciate it very much. Dan DeLoria is our guest, and let's go to Lee, Massachusetts, and Cindy. Cindy, you're on.
Hi, Dan. I would like your opinion on the electric utility companies shoving the smart meters down our throats without informing us of the dangers. And I also know that they charge very high fees to opt out, and Vermont happens to be a free opt-out state, one of the better states, not like Massachusetts.
Yeah, well, I mean, as it happens, Cindy, I was involved in setting smart meters on a path to where now I think it's up to close to 90% of the meters in the U.S. are smart meters. And a smart meter, it's basically means a meter that communicates two ways with the utility and maybe with the electricity system, but also one that measures the use of your electricity in smaller increments, you know, 15 minutes or less.
Why is that a good thing?
Because it allows time of use pricing. Okay. It allows.
Wait, Dan, you're telling me your four smart meters? Is that what you're telling me? I just need to clarify.
No, right, so no swearing, Cindy. I got a feeling you're on the other side of this.
Very much so. And I also had to talk about and learn about some of the health issues in terms of the
RF
the radiation, the RF frequency, and so on back then. And it didn't prove out to be a health emergency.
Right, but dynamic pricing, you're okay with this.
Of course.
Now, I'll tell you one thing. Go ahead, Cindy. You go on. You say something, and then I'll say something, and then we'll move on.
Dynamic pricing, this is a way for them to spy on you and to raise your rates use it during peak. And also, what do you think about Oracle? They're involved in the Eversource smart meters, and they're buying the data because that proves that they're spying on you. What would Oracle have to be doing with smart meters? Dan, you're on the wrong side of this topic.
I appreciate that call, Cindy, but go ahead, Dan.
Well, I'll just finish by saying that time-based pricing makes the whole electricity system more efficient. And if enough people subscribe to it, meaning that energy use is shifted from one time period to next, that it means you need less in the way of power plants overall during different periods.
But you know,
so it actually makes the entire system more efficient and cheaper for all people that use
that is okay, Dan. All right, listen, I'll buy a lot of stuff.
Okay, let's
cheaper?
Go.
No, absolutely not. My utility okay. sent me a notice okay. and said, oh, we're going to put a new smart, I had a smart meter, but they updated it.
Yes.
And the next month, my bill was $630. So let's talk about that for a
minute.
Well,
I don't know why your bill was that. Well, I can only talk about smart meters. I mean, smart meters are infrastructure. So just as if they're building a new distribution or transmission line, that has to be paid for by the people who use the system. And so that is put as a little adder on, you know, it's approved by the regulators. It's a little adder that is put on your bill. I mean, that happens all the time, and smart meters are part of the utility grid.
But the dynamic pricing, it's more when people use it. That's not good.
Yes.
I'll have my family wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we'll do all our business between 2 and 10 in the morning. And then that's not the peak hour. It'll be cheaper.
Right. But the time of use pricing is a quid pro quo. Okay. You don't have to do time of use pricing. Nobody has ever required, no utility in the country has ever required all of
their
customers.
So they're not doing this yet? Dynamic pricing, peak hour pricing?
They're offering it as an option.
I see. Why is my bill going so high?
I don't know why your bill's so high.
All right. You know what,
Dan? Maybe I could come up with some ideas.
Maybe it's that sauna that electric sauna you put
in your bed.
Unfortunately, there's not room in my house for you. I couldn't even spell the word sauna on a piece of paper in my house. Let me tell you something. This conversation would be better with a bottle of bourbon and not on the radio. We'd have some fun.
I'll know what to bring other than my laptop.
But only during non-peak hours, Dan. Okay. Jim is in North Greenbush. Jim, you're on.
I couldn't even spell the word sauna.
Hey, you got to lower that a little bit, man. You got to lower the radio. All right, Jim.
Okay,
you got to go. So listen, Jim, call back, but you can't have the radio on when we go to you because it just doesn't sound that good, even though Dan and I sound great. Terry's in Guilford, Connecticut. Terry, go ahead.
Hi, in regard to those smart meters, there's a lot of fine print that goes along with that. And I guess also it depends on the state you're in. I mean, I'm here in Connecticut, but I do have a solar that's a lease system. And the inverter box has like an antenna on it. So it basically communicates to the operator of the power grid, and they could throttle the thing and change the amount of current that feeds back into the grid. I mean, ideally, the best thing is if you could afford to buy the whole solar system and pay for it outright so you don't have to deal with all the lease issues. And, of course, there's always maintenance with things. And I've had mine for 5 years. It's working really good.
Good.
Here.
That's great.
I was also... I called about the heat pumps, and I was thinking about heat pumps. I remember back in the late 1970s down in Florida, they used to have this combination air conditioning and heating that was basically, there was a reversing valve inside of the where the refrigerant, and back then they used R22, which is not allowed anymore by the EPA because of the ozone issues and all that. They would basically reverse it so that the condenser would, which is the side that gets hot, would be on the inside in the winter. Of course, down in Florida, you don't get the strong, the cold like you do up here.
Yeah.
But it generally works. But up here, most people that I've seen, installations are mostly not the ground-based. Where you're like putting one side against the earth, and that's really what you need to do to get some real efficiency out of it. And I've had thoughts of it. Of course, I really can't afford it, but I have like a vision of getting about 500 feet of like copper tubing and burying it like 5 feet underground. You know, like
now I see.
Big,
yeah, I see where you're going with this.
Roundabout to dissipate it. The ground temperature here is about 52 degrees Fahrenheit constantly at that depth. So I'd be able to work against that temperature when I heat. And, of course, when it gets really cold, I could, get backup heat from other heating, you know, regular heating systems. But
all right,
and also wood stove with a,
okay,
a fan attachment that actually pulls the air through the body of the stove.
Terry, so let me just stop you just for a second. It's almost bedtime for me, so let's have Dan make comment on this. We're almost out of time.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, because we're almost out of time, I'm going to say thanks, Terry, for, you know, talking about all of that. But I want to use the opportunity to get back to smart meters and time-based pricing.
Okay, go, man,
and
go.
Lower, I'm going to lower Ray's bill right before
really?
Your eyes and ears.
Okay,
yes.
Go.
So if I gave you a deal where I'd give you like 5 cents per kilowatt hour.
Right.
For almost every day of the year other than 8 or 10.
Okay.
And on those 8 or 10 days, there was a period called a critical price period on those days.
Right.
Where what you use then would be 30 cents. Okay? Now, would you take that?
I don't know.
Well, you don't know, but it sounds
depends
pretty
on
good.
Depends on how many bourbons I've had. I got to be honest with you.
But, I mean, that's the idea behind, you know, time-based pricing and dynamic pricing.
All
is
right.
It enough people shift, they save money on their own terms.
So this was your idea, huh? This was
well,
your idea. You're the guy.
I was a little bit involved in it.
Well,
yeah,
Cindy and Lee's not too pleased with
and
you,
also,
I got to be honest.
And also, I want to ask all the listeners to you know, write in if they like the shows when Ray and I spar a little bit.
Oh, I love having you on the show, Dan. All right, let's try to squeeze one more call in.
All right.
Jim is in North Greenbush. Jim, you're on.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
I'd like to know what your thoughts are on kinetic energy storage as opposed to batteries.
Kinetic? Like
it's
like a flywheel.
Yes.
Explain. Yeah. All right, we only have about 45 seconds here, Dan. So what do you know, Jim? What do you need to add to this? And then let's get Dan's comment. Apparently nothing. What do you know, Dan?
Oh, sorry. Well, I know that there were some major utility-scale storage projects based on a flywheel technology, and they didn't make it. I mean, theoretically, any way you can store energy, whether it's you know, storing it in a reservoir and then letting it fall through a turbine, we've talked about
pumped
hydro.
Yeah, and that seems very
good. I mean, any way you can do it, but I can't go any further on talking about flywheel technology.
What about giant capacitors? Could it be done?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, any way that you store it. I mean, I've talked before about these new types of long-term or long-duration energy storage technologies that include new iron flow batteries.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of up for grabs. Any way that you can store it and control it and produce it when you want it, that's the game.
So listen, you and I need to do a podcast. I'm not a podcast guy, but I think it would, given the right, only in non-peak hours, but we could do something, and it would be probably.
Oh, so it would be an off-peak podcast?
Yeah. Actually, almost everything I've done is off-peak, so it works out. Hey, Dan, thanks for being on the
All
show.
All right, thanks,
we'll
Ray.
See you next time. Support comes from Brown's Brewing Revolution Hall, located in historic Troy. Newly renovated event spaces with Hudson River views for weddings, corporate events, and more. Next door to Brown's Tap Room, brownsbrewing.com for more. Berkshire Orthopedic Acupuncture, owned and run by a sole practitioner with 11 years plus experience of clinical experience, that is, providing individualized treatments that blend traditional Chinese medicine with orthopedic techniques, BOA.health for more. At Bonham and Douglas Architects, an architecture and interior design studio creating custom restaurant interiors like Firefly in Lenox, Massachusetts, bd-arc.com. Well, wasn't that fun? Thanks to Dan DeLuria of Vermont Law and Graduate School for being here today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the calls. Sorry if we didn't get to your email or your call. Dan is a regular on this show. He'll be back. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer, that is. Thanks to Andrea Leong for answering the phones. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, not that contentious, it's gardening.